In investing, you actually have a lot of different ways to affect outcomes. It isn't simply about how good is your pipeline. And we put together this framework. There's five things that you can play with to affect your outcomes. The first one is capital. The second is deal flow. Third is the number of deals that you do. The fourth is your decision quality. How good is it? And finally, it is about the economics. How much of the upside can you capture? I think of venture portfolio as balancing two things. Number one is managing your risk. Second, it's playing for life-changing outcomes.
You have just heard from Jet Ng, founder of Angel School, an angel syndicate, and a fellowship program dedicated to helping emerging angels invest via their own syndicates. In the following, Jed shares his angel investing pro tips. So let us dive right in.
Thank you everyone for joining today. I've decided to call today's session Angel Investing Pro Tips. And this is from my lessons from being a self-taught venture investor and my journey to backing two unicorns to date. As a tech operator and venture builder, I built the world's largest API marketplace with an Andreessen Horowitz-backed startup back in around 2016. I'm a self-taught angel to date. I've got an exit. I've backed two companies at seed stage that have turned unicorn. Today, I run my own syndicate. This is a large angel investor network, and we've grown organically over the last 3 years. We're ending the year with 1,300 investors in our network. I started angelschool.vc, which is my latest venture. Basically, it's a venture education business to help angel investors through their life cycle from writing the first check up to the point where they become super angels like myself. Before we jump into it, I want to be sensitive that some of you might be new to this space. I want to cover off some terminology. So when I abbreviate things, you know what I actually mean. Firstly, there is something in the venture industry called carried interest. Sometimes we abbreviate it and just say carry. This is a percentage of profit retained by the investment vehicle as a performance incentive. It's basically like profit share. If I help my investors invest in a company and we invested $1 and then the company exits and it's worth $10, the way it works is that investors would get their first dollar back, the original capital, and then we would take 20% of the profit, which is $9. Okay, that's what carried interest is. And so the industry standard is 20%. There's another term called LPs or limited partners. These are the investors in a VC fund. They're relatively silent and passive. For what I do, running a syndicate or an angel network, we sometimes refer to our investors as LPs as well, just to equivocate those terms. It's not technically the same thing. I'm just explaining conceptually. LPs are basically investors backing the lead of a syndicate or the fund manager. And then on the other side, there is a general partner or GP. The fund manager, this is the fund manager who runs a VC fund. Their job is to do fundraising, to make investment decisions, and then share updates on how the portfolio is doing with their investors. And then a VC fund, this one will be quite self-explanatory. It's like a mutual fund, but for private market assets. So the investors or LPs, they will invest a fixed amount of capital into this fund that is controlled by the fund manager. And the fund manager is compensated on two things. One is 2% management fee a year. Typically, that's how it is. And then there's 20% carried interest. So in venture, if you hear the term 2 and 20, this is what we refer to, right? It's 2% a year and 20% of the carried interest, which is the upside on the deals. Important to note that for funds, there is a higher minimum check. On the low end, a very small fund, it might be a $250,000 ticket on the low end. It can go up to millions or tens of millions. And then finally, a syndicate. This is really what I specialize in. This is an informal group of investors. We pool capital into a single investment vehicle so that we can invest into a single asset. The proposition for the investors is we give them all our deal flow, all our diligence. And if they see a deal that they like, they just invest through our vehicle. In a way, it's about giving our investors the ability to construct their own portfolio. Because if any of you are interested in venture seriously, you probably realize that you don't want to be purely passive, right? Where you put some money into something and then you just see how it does. You actually want to get involved. The syndicate model tends to be better for that. I want to start this by talking about a few investing axioms. These are things that we hear all the time in venture, and I'm just going to tell you my take on it, whether or not I agree. The first idea, the first axiom is it better to have a good idea, but with an amazing group of executors, or you want to have an amazing idea with an average execution, right? We tend not to be, to see too much controversy here. I think generally everyone agrees that, hey, you know what? Ideas in and of themselves don't have value. You need people to execute. That's why we always favor team over ideas. The next one is it about the team or the market? Imagine you have a 2x2 axis. On a vertical axis, you have a team that doesn't perform very well on the bottom versus a rock star team on top. And then on the horizontal axis, a small market versus a ginormous market. Obviously, if you can imagine this 2x2, we'd be only interested in the top right quadrant. If you had to choose, the question is, would you rather have an amazing team in a good sized market, or would you rather have a pretty good team, but in an absolutely enormous market? Imagine these dots and on this 2x2, and where would you choose to play? This one, we tend to get into debates all the time. My view actually is that I favor a ginormous market over team. The reason is that the difference between a good-sized market and a ginormous market, imagine the difference between a billion-dollar market and trillion-dollar market is actually 1,000x. Whereas, what is the performance difference between a good team and an amazing team? Is it 20x, 30x, 50x? I don't know. I don't know what the number is. But certainly, the argument that I make is that, hey, you know what? Having an absolute ginormous market, you don't have to be as good in executing and still have very good outcomes. Another one that we like to talk about is defensibility. This comes up all the time. If you've talked to any startups, looked at any pitch decks, they will always talk about where's the source of defensibility. And people want to hear things like there's patents, there's data and tech, there are flywheels. So that is the perception. My view is that these things that people value, patents, data and tech, flywheels, all of these things are vastly overvalued. At the earliest stages of the company where most angel investors play, you really only have a defensibility hypothesis. It could be something if it gets big enough. Usually at the start, it doesn't really exist. What I've increasingly become attuned to is looking at sales and distribution. And I think it's really important given the venture funding climate right now where capital is scarce. Companies need to be able to have a robust business model with good unit economics and to be able to sell and distribute their product and to grow using that. So that's my view of defensibility. And then one more. You hear this all the time in venture. It's all about deal flow. Quality deal flow is all that matters. On the other hand, is it more about diligence? So is having choice deal flow more important, or is it more about decision making? You can ask different people. I think this one is philosophical. My answer is that I tend to favor diligence because when you're looking at companies, decision making and doing diligence is actually a real skill. This is where the alpha that we get as investors lies. It's in your ability to make smart decision making. It doesn't matter if you have all the deal flow in the world, but your diligence, your decision making is not that great in the first place. Obviously, you need deal flow to start with. So that's our take. You need deal flow, but assuming you have it, skill matters to make smart decisions. If you are looking to get into venture, what are your options? Broadly speaking, there are three different things. You could stay as an independent angel doing direct deals into startups. You can join and be part of a syndicate, or you can invest via a VC fund. These choices are not mutually exclusive. Doing one doesn't preclude you from the other. Really, it's about how you choose to allocate your capital. For VC funds, if you are looking to be an investor in a VC fund, you need to write a relatively large ticket. Let's call it $250,000 minimum. And it is a blind pool vehicle. You are entrusting that capital to a fund manager and say, I trust you to make me a return. And that's on the low end. This can go into the millions or tens of millions. generally speaking, it disqualifies 99% of angel investors. Unless you're a HNWI, you've got capital to play, then that's what you want to do. So if you look at your remaining options, you can be an independent angel or join a syndicate. I don't think these are mutually exclusive. And I do think that as angel investors, you should explore all your options and take advantage of other syndicates. The benefit for being part of a syndicate is that, assuming that is a good one, not everyone operates to the same standard. They should get you better deal access. They should be doing more work around filtering. There's also a diligence benefit. It does vary from syndicate to syndicate. They'll just toss a pitch deck and they do very little in terms of diligence. That's not how we operate. Generally speaking, I think if a syndicate wants to charge carried interest, they should be doing the diligence lift for investors and presenting a deal memo. And on both vehicles, whether you do an independent angel or invest through a syndicate, you have 100% decision control. You invest only in the deals that you want to. If you don't like it, you walk away. I generally don't believe in having any fixed commitments to be part of a syndicate. Most angel investors, they make their money on labor income. Your knowledge economy professionals, you're busy with that. You have to manage your career. You have to manage your families, all of these things. And so a well-functioning syndicate should be saving you time because they're finding the companies, they are doing diligence, they're packaging everything up into a data room for you to review. And then you still get to decide on whether or not to invest. Another argument can be diversification. Think about your average check as an angel investor. If you're writing up to maximum a $20,000 check, you might get into a pre-seed or seed stage company, but nothing beyond that. So your options are limited. Whereas on a syndicate, because we're pooling capital, they tend to write larger tickets. On the low end, it would be 100 or 200,000. In fact, for us this year, because we've grown such a big network, we did a deal where we wrote our first seven-figure check. So we're starting to play up market just because we can move that capital. And on the downside, what you have to decide for yourself as a trade-off of whether or not you join a syndicate is there's going to be some fees. You're sharing in the upside in terms of carried interest. And so you've got to decide if this is worth it for you. So that's my thoughts on your options between funds, syndicates, and doing direct deals as an angel. Next thing I want to talk about is investment thesis. This is really important because we all know so much about the world and it's a relatively small slice of the world. So we need to have some kind of focus, some kind of boundaries to be able to understand what is a good company, to be able to make smart decisions on the right company. The simplest form of an investment thesis is these three things. It's which sector or domain you invest in, which geography, it tends to be quite local, and which stage, the stage of the company, pre-seed, seed, series A, etc. This is mainly a function of capital, how much capital you have to play. If you think about your own experience, if you went through this and to think, hey, what drives my sector focus? The number one thing tends to be familiarity or expertise. What do you know? Do you work in cloud and therefore like you know that space and you believe you can pick winners? That's a much more credible argument than to invest in some place where you don't know anything. It can be a matter of affinity, something that you care about. It could be a matter of interest. What are you interested in? On geography, what we tend to find for angels is that this early stage capital is highly localized. Most of it is deployed within the same city or state or the country. I've been a US-centric investor for a number of years now, and we see deals all the time where it's a West Coast company, but the East Coast investment community doesn't even know about it. This is just the nature of the beast. I think that other geographies could be relevant to you if there is some connection. For instance, you are part of a cultural diaspora and you want to give back to your community. And then stage, like I said, is primarily a function of capital. If you're writing a 5K up to 10, maybe 50K check per deal, you are going to be playing at pre-seed up to seed stage. I think to get into seed to series A, you probably need to be doing 30K up to $500,000 tickets. Anything from series A onwards, you need $250,000 up to millions of dollars. So roughly speaking, the point is capital constraint, your check size determines your stage. Another key topic is around due diligence and decision-making. When you found a company, how do you actually decide if it's an interesting company, it's investment worthy or not? We start out with due diligence. I've got a checklist that I share with all of the founders that I work with. Once we enter diligence, I say, here's a list of things that I need. Now, you might not get everything, but I think it's important to know what you're looking for and to set the tone. Don't let founders push you around and say, oh, we don't have this. It's not ready. We don't need to do this. Nobody should ask for this. You might not get everything, but I think if you have a built-out checklist, then you're like setting the expectation of what you need. So when I do diligence, there are some things that I look for. The first one is the company standing. This will cover things like incorporation documents. Why? We just want to know that it's a registered and incorporated business, not somebody's garage project. We want to know that there are key hire employment agreements that the CEO, the key leadership, they are working full time. You want to make sure that there's IP assignment. This basically says that the inventions and work of employees belong to the company even after they leave. Shareholder agreements, this is about understanding your rights as an investor and the company governance structure. And then finally, vesting agreements for employee equity. Here, we're just looking for sensible equity vesting schedule. How much equity does each employee get? What is the vesting period? Typically, it's 3 to 4 years. And are there acceleration events? For example, when a company gets acquired. Next, for the company diligence, we ask for a number of things. Obviously, we get a pitch deck, self-explanatory. We are looking at financials. We're trying to understand if the company's growth logic and their assumptions make sense. Or are they just forecasting 30% monthly growth year over year, and then it's mathematically correct, but not quite realistic. We also want to know what is the burn of the company and runway. This is about managing risk. For sales, marketing, and go-to-market, how does this company plan to generate leads? How are they going to close sales? We want to know their product roadmap, ideally in the next 12 months. At the early stages, I generally don't care too much beyond 12 or 24 months, right? Things shift too much for startups. We're looking at team structure. What does the org chart look like? Where are they hiring for? If it's a company that is doing B2B, they might have customer sales contracts or pilot agreements. We would want to study those to make sure that what they're claiming is actually true. And we want to look at their cap table. The cap table is just the equity and ownership structure of the company. And when you do this, make sure that you ask for what's called the pro forma and fully diluted version. The reason is that there might be a lot of convertible instruments, warrants, options, and these sorts of things that technically are not shares, and they have an effect on equity dilution. So the pro forma fully diluted version gives you a view of what that looks like after all of these vehicles have converted. And then finally, investment documents. This is to confirm the investors against the pro forma cap table, and we want to know what are the terms and the vehicle of the current investment. Take this checklist. Remember all of these things, and it's a simple thing to ask a founder. Here's what I'm looking for. Make sure they package it up for you and you start digging in from there. After you get all of this, how do you actually evaluate the startups? We've developed our own structure for doing this. There are 7 different things that we look at. So I'll explain what these are and then I'll talk about what we look for. For product or service, very simple. I just want to know what this business does. For the market, we want to know who your buyer segment is. What is their willingness to pay? How big is this market? I think market sizing is one of these things that people are quite careless about. Founders, they've got an incentive to make the market size seem ginormous and huge. But if you actually define it properly, what does that look like? You as an investor, you should do your homework and validate these numbers. Is it a $100 million market? A 10 billion one, 100 billion, those are very big differences. For business economics, we're looking to know what is the value of each sale. For every unit of product or service that you sell, how much revenue do you get? And out of that, how much profit do you get out of each sale? It's that simple. And then sources of defensibility. I think it's helpful to frame it as what is hard to build about this business. If it was easy for everyone to do it, then it's not truly defensible. But if you can solve a particularly hard problem that nobody else can, this is where you get value from. On traction, you should know your metrics. Depending on what you choose to invest in, you want to know your metrics and apply them correctly. So just a few examples for users. We are looking at lifetime value and customer acquisition costs. We're looking at growth rates. for marketplace businesses or fintech businesses also, we look at GMV, the transactions processed, and also the take rate. How much percent does the platform take? For revenue, besides the dollar number, we're looking for ARR, annual recurring revenue, and then another metric called net recurring revenue, which basically says, do customers spend more or less after a year, let's say? We also look at other things like profitability and the capital efficiency. It's not as impressive if you're growing 30% month over month, but you're burning $1 million a month. It's just not that good. And then for the team, this one is subjective. I'm trying to answer the question, are these serious and committed founders? And do they know the space that they are building for? This probably isn't a very popular opinion, and people don't like to say it out loud because it seems a bit adversarial. But the reality is that building something from scratch, it's a lot of work. Not everyone is cut out for it, and that's okay. There is no shame. But I do think a lot of people get into startups and they want to be founders for the wrong reasons. You've got to make that determination to say, does this make sense for you? Or do you actually trust and bet on this team? And finally, for valuation, I simply ask the question, is the company fairly priced? This is an important perspective for angel investors because for the most part, you have no bargaining power. You are price takers. And the optimal decision that you can make is to just understand, is this fair value for this startup or not? And if you believe in the long-term prospects, it's really that simple. It's what price are you buying in? And realistically, what price do you think you can get out at? Those are the things that we look at, and how we address each of these things are as follows. On a product or service, I ask this simple question, right? Is what you're building differentiated by an order of magnitude? Is it 10x better or is it 10% better? Because one is certainly a lot more interesting than the other. Second, the market size. I go back to that axiom and say, you know what? Big and huge markets differ by 1,000x. There's just a huge difference. We look for big companies, especially they want to IPO because it gives them a realistic chance where they can IPO or they can get acquired. On business economics, this is something I'm very sensitive to. I like businesses where there's high revenue quality. It's sticky. Customers might spend more over time and you get thick margins on every sale. And unit profits can be used to drive growth instead of raising equity financing, which means that all of us get diluted as investors. So companies that know how to make money, that's great. That's totally my thing. For defensibility, we're looking to answer the question, what assets could this company build for or do they have that makes it hard for others to replicate your business? And traction, for me, traction on the business is about de-risking it and to validate if things like your go-to-market strategy is working. And then team, we look for serious entrepreneurs. Again, it's a very subjective judgment. You have to decide for yourself. Are they serious entrepreneurs? Do they have the skills to execute? The best test for me is that, do they have skin in the game? Have they put in a lot of work in stealth over the last couple of years to build something up before raising financing? That's what I want to see. And then again, valuation, it's about buying in at the right price today and then having a realistic view of the long-term exit value. Next topic, I want to talk about this idea of success levers. Again, I'm challenging the axioms that we talked about earlier. It's all about deal flow and all of these things. And I completely disagree. I think it just becomes one of these reductive tropes that people just regurgitate over and over again. Because if you think about it, in investing, you actually have a lot of different ways to affect outcomes. It isn't simply about how good is your pipeline and all of these things. We put together this framework that looks like this. There's five things that you can play with to affect your outcomes. The first one is capital. The second is deal flow. Third is the number of deals that you do. The fourth is your decision quality. How good is it? And finally, it is about the economics. How much of the upside can you capture? Very quickly, number one question, how much capital can you deploy? As an angel, you're thinking about your stock of capital today. You're planning in the future. You've got career progression and these things maybe give you more money and you can put more capital into venture. And you can also think about scaling it up. So for what I do, a lot of the motivation behind running a syndicate is to scale capital. Instead of investing $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 of my own money per company, I can write a $250,000 or $500,000 check with a larger pool of capital and we get into better deals and we get a lot of advantages. On deal flow, you need to be thinking about how much deal flow are you receiving? How can you grow your pipeline? And how can you grow access? So simple things like if you are looking to expand your deal flow, if you know what you invest in, why not build relationships with other investors? And that gives you a way to see other things from people with the same thesis as you. For deals done, how many deals are you executing on? This often is a function of just time. You got to take care of your families and all of these things. It's also helpful to have an efficient screening process. Also, over time, how big are you building your portfolio? Then on decision quality, fundamentally, how good is your decision making? What is the probability that you have invested into a successful company? On the economics, how much do you capture from an exit? As an angel, it's pretty straightforward. It's whatever valuation that you invest in, whatever valuation that you exit, minus some factor of dilution, and that is the return that you get. But for funds or syndicates, you actually do improve your economics because of this carried interest structure that I talked about earlier. Okay, so the point of this is think about the different weapons that you have to play. This is how I approach venture investing. The whole game is how do I maximize the probability of success? There, it's a much broader discussion. And I think the last thing we will talk about is portfolio construction. This one comes up a lot. People talk about, okay, how should I allocate assets to venture? I think of venture portfolio as balancing two things. Number one is managing your risk. Second, it's playing for life-changing outcomes. Let's go deeper into some of these things. Firstly, if you are newer to this space, you need to be able to accept risk. Assuming that whatever you invest into venture could go to zero, you need to be prepared to walk away. You cannot expect liquidity until an exit event. Even if there's an equity round and the shares are valued, there might not be a buyer. This is the reality. So you need to be able to hold on all the way. You don't get to cash out like a stock exchange. Second, take your time. I can't stress this enough. I think one of the mistakes I made when I first started is that I got too excited too quickly. Right? Every company looked interesting and it's just like such a fascinating space if you're into this. But deal flow is limitless. Your capital is finite. My recommendation is get lots of exposure, see lots of pitch decks, talk to all kinds of founders, but be very stingy about writing checks because once you do, you might not get that money back. Keep your earlier euphoria in check. The third thing, you hear this in venture also. People say diversification matters. You need to build a big portfolio. Yes, true. The more companies you have positions in, the more likely that you'll hit a home run winner. But it also means that home run winner needs to make up for all the losers. I would say, generally speaking, let's say you have one winning company out of every 10 or 20 startups that you back. Be committed to building a portfolio, but over time. Next, think about the outcome levers. You have multiple ways to improve your odds of venture success. These are tools in your toolbox or weapons in your arsenal. You can do more deals, write bigger checks, or improve your skill on doing due diligence. All of these things actually matter a lot. And then think about trade-offs. All of those levers that I mentioned, there is a bit of a tension and a conflict. You need to set up your own trade-off for your own philosophy. For example, by writing a larger check, you get to do deeper diligence and that improves your odds of success. But if you're writing a bigger check into a single company, it means you cannot spread that capital out into others as well. Next, the reality check. If you are starting out, generally speaking, this is what holds true. Maybe not for everyone, but generally speaking, you are going to be low on skills and experience because you haven't done this yet. You have a finite pool of capital for venture, and it's not something you're in control of. It doesn't significantly increase in the near term. Access to deal flow is constrained, again, largely a function of capital. It's good to make small bets early. There is a difference between playing online poker with chips versus going to a casino and invest, right? The psychology is very different. Once you stake your own capital in the company, you feel it much more sharply. It's important that you experience this. The same like if you were to do equity investing, you need to be able to manage the psychology. However, your decision-making is the poorest when you're starting out. For me, it makes more sense to make undersized bets early. It's also an area where syndicates help you improve deal access. You get package up diligence so you can learn from that and they help you diversify. That's one way to spread yourself out and to learn in a much safer way. Next, diversify over time. Again, capital is finite. Don't be in a rush. You only should do venture if you're in it for the long game. You can diversify by building a portfolio over a period of years. Don't rush into it. Don't invest in 10 companies on your first year and then you're stuck waiting for something to happen. The next thing is to invest for life-changing outcomes. I think the whole point of venture is to get outsized returns. You want a 10x, 20x, 50x, or 100x your money. If you back the company that returns 100x, which is a phenomenally good outcome, and you invested $1,000, that 100x is into 100,000, it's okay if you did a 10,000 check and you 100x to $1 million, and now we're talking. I want to share this nuance for you. Making small bets early makes sense to help you learn the game. But at some point, you need to graduate and write meaningful tickets so that you can do really well. I'm a firm believer that building skill on diligence is a critical thing. It takes many reps, a lot of time to develop. And so for all of you, if you're interested in venture, you want to start working on this early and train your own decision-making list because this pays off for you in the long term. Join syndicates. I'm not trying to plug mine. I do have one, but I'm just saying, let somebody else do the heavy lift for you. Their job is to find companies, do diligence on your behalf. Meanwhile, you have 100% decision control over the portfolio, what you invest in. Of course, not every syndicate has the same high standard, so vet carefully. It's one of the things that I don't like about this space. I think there's too many cowboys that actually don't know what they're doing. And when you're ready, think about scaling up. If you want to build a syndicate, go for it. You access more capital, you write bigger checks, and you're removing personal capital as a constraint. I'll just end with this, just a quick plug. I actually just launched a new program called Venture Fundamentals. This is to give emerging angel investors all the essential venture knowledge in 10 hours. It's completely online. We've just done our first program in November with 70 users from 22 different countries. So we're really proud of this, that we're able to help a lot of new angels get into this space and help them make their first investments. So I'll leave it here.